You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
Senator McCain, when you were talking about Barack Obama in a recent speech, an audience member called him a terrorist and you said nothing. In a speech by Sarah Palin, an audience member yelled that they should kill Barack Obama and she said nothing. Are you going to allow this negative, dangerous tone to continue? Well, what do you have to say? I see, nothing.
What do you mean, really, when you say bomb Obama in America with our history? The ugly campaign rhetoric led to a scathing editorial today in the Baltimore Sun by Republican author Frank Schaefer, who writes that he worked to get Senator McCain elected in 2000. Schaefer writes, quote, John McCain, if your campaign does not stop equating Senator Barack Obama with terrorism, questioning his patriotism, and portraying Mr. Obama as not one of us, I accuse you of deliberately feeding the most unhinged elements of our society, the red meat of hate, and therefore of potentially instigating violence. You are doing this in wartime. You are doing this as our economy collapses. You are doing this in a country with a history of assassinations.
That guy gets elected, he hangs around with terrorists.
Who's the terrorist?
Obama.
Obama's a terrorist, don't you know that?
Obama's a Muslim, he's a terrorist himself.
Commie faggot!
Socialist swine.
You're gonna go to Russia.
Screw Obama! Boo!
The question of ruling after this and bringing the country together, it's going to be all the more harder to do that, whoever wins, with all this anger out there.
I think one of the most striking things we've seen now in the last few days, we've seen them in the Palin rallies, now we saw the McCain rally today, and we saw it to a considerable degree during the rescue package legislation. There is this free-floating sort of whipping around anger that could really lead to some violence. And I think we're not far from that, and
really?
That's why I think it's so well. I really worry when we get people, when you get the kind of rhetoric that you're getting at these rallies now, I think it's really imperative that the candidates try to calm people down.
European socialist,
do you think they
Bill Ayers, you scumbag,
you think they should die, sir? You think they should die?
Everyone dies, don't they?
Wow.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's fully independent, non-corporate indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. If you like your news and information spoon-fed to you by the corporations and their handlers, the six mega businesses that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio, this is not the show for you. If you like alternative non-corporate voices from around the country and the world, then this is your home. Feel free to come in out of the cold. We got a great lineup for you inside this week's show, so let's get right to it. This hour we'll be bringing you a shortened Eat the State, a news and review segment produced out of Seattle. Later this hour will be a piece I produced for the alternative media world, This Week in Radical History. Sometime between now and the end of the second hour of this week's show, you'll be hearing the shows I try to bring you each and every week, including but not limited to Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Women's E-News, Peak Oil Check-In, This Week in Palestine, Black Agenda Radio, and In Season with Lisa. Also this week, for the first time, I discovered Latin Radical Radio. Great show, and I hope to bring you to it in the future. This Week has a great report about our former involvement and a warning of future involvement in El Salvador elections by the powers to be of the good old U.S. of A. That's the type of alternative voices from around the country and the world you get each and every week, only here on The Mike Cannon Show. Let's jump off with a little bit of goofiness I'd like to throw in here and there to lighten the load. So sit back and take a load off your feet and enjoy the show.
Heads up!
America, your government is at work to deal with the misuse of force by private contractors like the mercenary firm Blackwater. Your government created the FIU, the Force Investigation Unit. We then proceeded to staff the FIU with private contractors. For who better to investigate the crimes of private contractors than other private contractors? Your U.S. government, because only we understand how complex the military-industrial complex is!
All right. That moves us on then to this week's national news and the economy, briefly.
I know Maria had a great deal more that she wanted to say, so I didn't do a lot of preparation on this week. I did want to note that the G7 has been meeting over the past few days to try and hash out an international response to this, and that really underscores a core nature of this problem, which is that even compared to, say, 10 years ago when we had the Asian financial markets with all of their problems, the technology has changed so rapidly in terms of the globalization of international capital and how the global markets work, that we're really in uncharted waters here in terms of how the markets might be melted down. And at the same time, it really underscores how the regulatory regimes for this, both domestically and internationally, simply have not kept up with technology. And in fact, it's been exactly the wrong time to deregulate. That being said, I know Maria wanted to talk also at one point about how all of the doomsday media coverage of this, talking about, you know, global financial collapse and things like that, is really now overstating the severity of the issue, just as they were understating it for the past couple of years during the housing bubble and as the subprime mortgage crisis cascaded into the current situation that we have. So, let's just touch on those points briefly and leave it to the expert to talk about it next week.
Okay, very good. Moving on. Sarah Palin this week and some ethics charges.
Yes, the state of Alaska in a commission that included 11 different Republicans, even though the McCain campaign is now trying to decry the whole exercise as a partisan witch hunt, it wasn't. Came out with a ruling yesterday in a classic Friday afternoon news dump that Sarah Palin, as governor of Alaska, abused her power, violated the law, and also illegally pressured a number of state employees underneath her to violate the law in trying to get a state trooper in Alaska fired for personal reasons. Now, in the annals of abuse of power, this is a relatively minor infraction. Nobody's saying this compares with, oh, say, you know, lying to get our nation into an unnecessary and illegal war, or you know, firing U.S. attorneys for political reasons or anything like that. But what it does demonstrate is that Sarah Palin, and this is something that we've seen pretty consistently throughout her brief and unremarkable political career, is petty. She is vindictive. She abuses her power for personal reasons, and she has very little contempt for the rule of law. And haven't we really seen this enough in a vice president? So this I think is probably one more nail in the coffin of the McCain Palin campaign. We've also seen there was the rather amusing, if repulsive, spectacle yesterday of John McCain slapping down his own followers when they started booing Barack Obama and saying that they were scared that he was an Arab and Arab and whatnot in a town meeting hall. This is sort of like setting a house on fire and then wanting credit because you show up at the scene of the arson with a bucket of water. McCain and Palin have really been playing with hate in terms of the sort of coded racial appeals and the incitements to hate that they've been trying to whip up in a lot of their followers in sort of their last ditch desperate attempt to make this a competitive race because they have so little you know, so little traction on economic issues. You know, Ayers hasn't stuck. A lot of this stuff hasn't stuck. And they've really been, especially Palin, appealing to the worst in their followers. And it's really been very, very frightening to watch. And I think that's what should stick with voters, not McCain's supposedly honorable attempt to put out the fire that he himself helped start.
All right. And Connecticut.
Yeah, very good news, briefly, because we're running out of time here. A Supreme Court ruling in the state of Connecticut yesterday ruled that civil unions are unconstitutional for gay couples. Why are they unconstitutional? Because they don't allow gay marriages. In other words, civil unions themselves have been used by timid politicians as a way, as a sort of separate but equal clause, that you can have all of the rights of married couples, but governments will not allow you to actually be married because that's only for a man and a woman. And the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled that no, you have to allow gay marriage. It's an unappealable ruling. And so on October 28th, Connecticut will be the first state, or the third state rather, to allow gay marriage legally, and the first state to say that civil unions specifically are an unconstitutional substitute for that.
All right, and very briefly, Iraq.
Just a couple of things to flag in Iraq. The surge, once again, has still got all sorts of problems that we're not hearing about in U.S. media. A report from Patrick Coburn in The Independent yesterday that cholera is becoming widespread once again, and a new national intelligence estimate that came out this week that got very little media attention, especially in the, when it came out immediately after, John McCain's debate performance, saying once again that the surge has led to victory in Iraq. The NIE saying that Iraq isn't won yet, that there is still a lot of very significant challenges remaining there, and a lot of things that can and are going wrong.
Heads up.
My friends, one of the reasons you should vote for me, and I've said this several times, is that I know how to get Osama bin Laden. I'll get him. I know how to get him. And if you want to know, you need to elect me, because I'm not telling unless you elect me.
Hey, John, can you at least tell me how to get him?
No, only I know. It's my secret, and I'm not telling until you swear me in. Country first. I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
How does an empire know when it's beginning to fail? Even as Rome steadily debased its currency and replaced its legions with foreign mercenaries, it's unlikely that people walked the streets in a daze muttering about their decline and fall. In 1945, Winston Churchill still thought he represented one of the world's three superpowers. Even after the loss of India, Harold Macmillan still didn't get it, embarking on a last colonial hurrah in Egypt without obtaining the permission of an actual superpower. When Gorbachev initiated Glasnost in 1985, he thought he was renewing socialism, not causing its destruction, let alone in a mere 6 years. With the United States, it's a little different. Collapse is predicted so continually that it's just part of the background noise. Over 60 years of a national security complex ceaselessly whipping up fear about remote eventualities has created a population that constantly mixes great prosperity with rampant insecurity. Every time China sells a shirt, Americans panic that they will lose everything and be subjugated to strutting yellow overlords. As for intellectuals, there's always the institutionalized left and a few fellow travelers. The financial crisis and accompanying economic downturn has vindicated the Marxist economists who constantly prophesy crisis through good times and bad, who, in the words of Robert Brenner, have predicted 5 out of the last 2 crises. And they have their counterparts who constantly prophesy the end of the American empire. Without wanting to add to this body of literature and the dying mass of trees it represents, I think the time has come for a little reflection on the subject. While the United States will retain its preeminent position for the foreseeable future, many of the underpinnings of American dominance have been badly shaken in the past 8 years. First, last, and always, of course, there was the Iraq War. Because of the ugly rhetoric of the Bush administration, and because the world was a little tired of 12 years of unquestioned unipolar dominance mixed with extreme sanctimony, the war caused a huge loss of legitimacy for American global leadership. The spectacle of the most advanced military in the world, fought to a standstill by ragtag bands of undereducated men and boys, their growth stunted by 12 years of sanctions, armed only with Kalashnikovs and RPG launchers, certainly helped. The last time anything similar had happened, it also hit U.S. imperial prestige pretty hard. But military failure alone was not then and is not now enough to actually alter the world's political map. China's defection to the American camp alone was enough to offset America's loss in Vietnam. Despite America's amazing number of military interventions, war was never the signature underpinning of the American empire. The extreme inventiveness of its corporate titans and the rapidity with which its economic modalities took over the world were the key. After the end of the Cold War, this was most striking. In less than a decade, the Washington Consensus had spread through most of the Milky Way. Of course, said consensus would seem hopelessly old-fashioned to the heroic inventors of credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations which took over the world in a few years at most. After 30 years of America's constantly telling the rest of the world how to run its economy, the credit market crash and bailout are likely to cause a worldwide revulsion against listening any longer. Another key component of American dominance has simply been the effortless affluence of Americans and the signal it sends to the world. At this point, though, anyone with a clue knows that we've been living in affluence we didn't actually have. Easy credit has overnight become hard. From pestering random college students to get credit cards, we've come to banks being unwilling to lend money to other banks. This may be a temporary swing, but if things swing back, we'll have more problems of this kind. And finally, unlike in any other case of American economic crisis, we depend for our recovery on foreign creditors, especially the Pacific Rim countries. China sends its money here to stagnate in crappy low-yield treasury bonds while soliciting over $1 trillion of foreign direct investment. So far, they're throwing good money after bad because if they withdraw their support, the dollar will crash and their dollar-denominated bonds will lose value. But this can't go on forever. Since Americans remain unwilling to finance the country themselves, the United States cannot control its own fate. I don't know what all this adds up to. Neither does anyone else. Capitalism in the United States are highly resilient, to say the least. But it's certainly a wake-up call for the masters of the universe. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Public access educational and governmental television, or PEG stations, are local TV channels that broadcast programming as diverse as the communities they are based in, ranging from local music videos to city council meetings to community sporting events and a whole lot in between. But the people who make PEG stations a reality have been facing a number of challenges over the past 2 years, including new state laws and FCC regulations, which have been detrimental to PEG access centers and programming across the country. Last month, a congressional committee held a hearing on the impact of these new rules. Barbara Popovich, executive director of Chicago Access Network Television, or CAN-TV, and member of the Alliance for Community Media, testified at the hearing.
The question at hand was, has localism and diversity been set aside? This is what Representative Serrano, the chair, kept saying. Has this been set aside in the interest of ushering more competition into the marketplace? And I would say the answer to that is decidedly yes.
A sizable portion of the hearing was spent discussing the impact of AT&T's video service, UVerse, on PEG channels. Popovich explains that since UVerse is delivered using new digital technology, it should have even more flexibility than cable to offer the kind of benefits that viewers have come to expect, such as faster channel changes and instant information about programming. But PEG actually doesn't benefit in ways you might expect.
None of that applies to PEG access, which does not carry closed captioning, no second audio programming. You cannot channel surf between commercial and PEG channels. You basically have a reduced quality because you're looking at a smaller screen. It's like an internet, and it takes time for that application to load. So what this says is that here's a corporation that has made the business decision that the public, the educational institutions, the local governments do not count.
Popovich believes that active citizens in each community can impact the policy decisions that shape our media system, including those regarding community media.
And I think it's important to tell your public officials at the local, state, and federal level, as well as any discourse that you have with the campaigns for our presidential candidates, that it is important to preserve public media like PEG Access, community radio. It's very important that we have information at the local level and that policies must follow and protections must be put in place to be sure this exists for the local community.
For more information on the fight to protect PEG Access, go to keepusconnected.org.
And now, a commentary by Free Press blogger Megan Tatey.
My dad called me recently from his home in Oklahoma City, aghast. I'd been telling him about the problem of the digital divide, but it's hard for him to understand when he can jump online in a matter of seconds. But something he heard on local radio stunned him. A woman called in and told the host she didn't have internet access where she lived outside the city. She was hoping to get more information about Republican presidential candidate John McCain. According to my dad, she said, "Now I hear John McCain was in a war. Does that mean he's going to be a war president?" Sure, you don't need the internet to learn the basics of McCain's biography. But tens of millions of Americans do not have the equal ability to educate themselves about this crucial election. Half of the population can easily access newspapers and magazines from across the country and around the world to find a variety of opinions about the candidates. They can watch videos of stump speeches, read a blog post about the merits of a candidate's stance on an issue, or do their own investigation into campaign contributions. The other half must rely on what the mainstream media decide to offer viewers and readers for political coverage. The digital divide isn't just about relegating people to slow email. It's about thwarting people's civic engagement, preempting their cultural participation, and ultimately stifling democratic action. Presidential contenders Barack Obama and John McCain have been debating on national TV. Viewers with broadband don't have to rely on just the moderators and pundits. They can use their internet connection to research the facts and the fiction. But once again, the other half of the population will be hamstrung, only able to get the spin they are being fed by the networks. The next president must adopt policy that rolls out open, affordable, high-speed internet access to all Americans. It is essential that every American has equal and open access to the internet in order to fully participate in elections and in our democracy. Here's a first step. Perhaps one of the debate moderators could ask the next president, "How will you bring a universal, affordable broadband to all Americans?"
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of October 11, 2008. I'm Sandy Billings.
And I'm Ana Maria Roque.
Let's start with the good news. Cheers, a new cancer vaccine is urged. A leading British scientist says new research reveals that a vaccine or drug to prevent breast cancer is plausible. Valerie Baral is the director of the Cancer Epidemiology Unit of Oxford University. She also urged the scientific community to turn its focus toward breast cancer prevention, where efforts are minimal in comparison to the funding and research dedicated to breast cancer treatment. Beryl leads the Million Women Study, which has proven that breast cancer is caused by the absence of hormonal changes linked to childbirth. Because women have fewer children and breastfeed less than they did historically, breast cancer rates have increased as a result. Baral says that studying hormonal surges caused by childbirth and mimicking those efforts could lead to a vaccine, but the necessary research isn't taking place. Death rates from breast cancer have dropped, but the actual number of cases is increasing. In recent years, a growing body of U.S. studies have also revealed racial and income discrepancies that affect how women receive early treatments, which may play a role in breast cancer death rates. October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. The Susan G. Komen For the Cure Foundation announced that it will distribute $1 million in grants to researchers this year. Investigating whether a vaccine can be developed is one of seven major research areas the foundation is targeting.
More news to cheer this week. The Connecticut Supreme Court granted same-sex couples the right to marry because it found that civil union guarantee fewer rights and thus are discriminatory. In a November 4th election, voters will decide if the state should allow for a constitutional convention to have a same-sex marriage ban put on the ballot. The United Nations announced the implementation of a program designed to improve gender equity in the African countries of Mozambique, Rwanda, Senegal, Sierra Leone, and Tanzania. The $8 million three-year program will provide access to resources and services to women at the local level. In Guinea, women's rights activists are condemning blockades that prevent women from achieving powerful political and civil positions as they look ahead to the December elections. Only 24 seats in the 114-member parliament are held by women. Activists also want to improve girls' education because only 20% of adult women in Guinea are literate. Reproductive rights activist Dr. Henry Morgenthaler, best known for his long legal battle to strike down Canada's abortion laws 20 years ago, was awarded the Order of Canada, the highest civilian honor in the country. Malalai Yoya, who was removed from the Afghanistan parliament in 2007 for criticizing fellow lawmakers, received the Anna Politkovskaya Award. Politkovskaya was an outspoken Russian journalist who was murdered in Moscow in 2005. Yoya consistently receives threats for campaigning for women's rights.
Now for the downside of the news, jeers for news that Roe's future depends on the upcoming election. The presidential election may determine the future of legalized abortion. The next president is likely to appoint at least one new Supreme Court justice and may appoint as many as three. Justice John Paul Stevens is 88 years old and leads the narrow majority that has sought to uphold Roe, the 1973 decision that legalized abortion. Indiana University law professor Dawn Johnson is a former lawyer for NARAL Pro-Choice America. She told the LA Times, quote, "Clearly, Roe is on the line this time. It is quite clear they have four votes against it. If the next president appoints one more, the odds are it will be overruled." An August Pew Research Center poll found that 54% of Americans believe abortion should be legal in general, and 41% say it should be mostly legal. Two state initiatives on the ballot this November have the potential to become test cases to overturn Roe. In Colorado, the so-called Personhood Amendment would define a fertilized egg as a human being, which could imperil birth control access as well as the right to an abortion. An October 6 Denver Post poll found that 48% of state voters opposed the initiative, 30% supported it, and 22% were undecided. In South Dakota, voters will decide whether to ban all abortions in the state except those necessary to preserve a woman's life or in cases of rape and incest. A stricter ban had failed in 2006, but proponents believe that adding the exceptions to the ban will be more appealing to voters this year.
More news to cheer this week. Human Rights Watch reports that lesbian and bisexual women and transgender people face violent beatings, forced marriages, rape, and everyday humiliation in Kyrgyzstan. This occurs in both family settings and from strangers on the street. The Human Rights Watch has called on the government to step up its response to violence based on gender and sexual orientation. Voice of America reports that a group of 100 men sexually assaulted women in a middle-income Cairo neighborhood as the holy month of Ramadan concluded. Egypt has seen similar mass sexual assaults in the past years, mostly occurring during holidays and public gatherings. The Egyptian Center for Women's Rights said that for the first time, the government is acknowledging the problem. An influential Saudi cleric announced his preference that women reveal only one eye and veil the other, arguing that having both eyes revealed encourages women to look seductive and use makeup. Over 20 Sudanese women were arrested and beaten for violating an edict against bad behavior. They wore tight trousers or short skirts. Most women were rounded up by police after leaving a Catholic service.
Also noted in the news this week, a female battalion of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, runs its own assault and command structure and is fighting for Kurdish rights. These news briefs were compiled by Ulia Anglescu. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. Background music is by Joan Hickey. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yin Radio. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Sandy Billings.
And I'm Anna Maria Roque.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protest. And I
this is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Anita's still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town like in the Ninth Ward where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Sari Williams.
And I'm Diane Farsetta. In our top spin, will the Pentagon pundits or their media hosts be held accountable? Back in April, the New York Times revealed that the Pentagon regularly met with, fed talking points to, and sometimes funded overseas trips for retired military officers who are frequent media commentators. Internal Pentagon documents referred to the pundits as surrogates and message force multipliers. The Pentagon began the program in 2002 to help sell the Iraq War. It later expanded to promote Bush administration policies in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay and on warrantless wiretapping. Many of the Pentagon pundits also work for military contractors. Now the Federal Communications Commission is investigating. On October 2nd, the FCC sent letters of inquiry to 19 pundits and 5 television networks. CBS and ABC confirmed that they received letters. The FCC is focusing on whether the failure to reveal the pundits' Pentagon and contractor ties broke disclosure rules. The FCC is asking the pundits and networks to reply within 30 days.
Speaking of propaganda, here's more on the new three-year, $300 million Iraq Information Operations contract. The Pentagon awarded the contract to 4 firms, SOS International, Lincoln Group, MPRI, and Leonine Industries. The firms will produce websites, print columns, press statements, press releases, speeches, editorials, documentary and entertainment shows, and radio programs on economics and sports topics. Iraqi stations and their audiences usually don't know that the broadcast material is from the U.S. government. As its communications targets, the contract lists, quote, Iraqi, Pan-Arabic, international, and U.S. audiences, end quote. However, U.S. law bans propagandizing U.S. audiences.
Can you imagine planning another big-ticket junket after getting bad press like this?
After the bailout of AIG last month, the United States government effectively bought an 80% share in the company. That should have caused a fundamental change, you would think, in how the company was spending funds on compensation, bonuses, and benefits. But it doesn't look like that's what happened. Shortly after the bailout went through, executives from AIG's major U.S. life insurance subsidiary held a week-long conference at an exclusive resort.
That was Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings, questioning why insurance company AIG spent $440,000 on a conference after receiving a government bailout. More recently, AIG received a second government loan and was about to hold another event at a luxury resort. Instead of curbing spending, AIG executives wanted to run ads explaining why the posh events are necessary. But their public relations consultant warned that spending, quote, the taxpayers' money on an expensive ad campaign to apologize for how you use taxpayer money leaves you open to further attacks, end quote. AIG then canceled the second event, which was scheduled for mid-October at California's Half Moon Bay.
Quick, what do you think of when you think of Israel? According to the Israeli Foreign Ministry and its image consultants, you probably said the Israel-Palestine conflict. The Israeli government is working to change that, with help from a British firm that specializes in country brand capital development. Israel hired the firm Akanchi in August. The firm says Israel's new brand should highlight the country's scientific and cultural achievements. Akanchi previously helped rebrand Lebanon and Northern Ireland.
And now it's time to play 6 degrees of spin and faking, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned MPRI, one of 4 firms working on the new information operations contract in Iraq. MPRI, which stands for Military Professional Resources Incorporated, was launched in 1987. It's helped run ROTC recruitment centers at hundreds of universities across the United States. Internationally, MPRI has worked with the Nigerian military, the Croatian army, and the Angolan police. As part of Plan Colombia, the firm helped the U.S. Defense Department and the Colombian government to plan the so-called war on drugs. MPRI's past communications work includes organizing Defense Department-sponsored media seminars in Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and the Ukraine.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
We're gonna rise up and take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This week in radical history for the week starting October 13th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, more radical info was found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio segments are being borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for October 13th, 1855, in Grenada, William Walker takes a private army into Grenada to overthrow the government on this date. Walker runs around a lot of South America taking over governments here and there while passing laws to bring back slavery into fashion. Not surprisingly, he is supported by volunteers and supplies from the Southern Confederacy states. Walker is even recognized as president of Nicaragua by the U.S. president. Eventually would be captured and killed by a firing squad. Well deserved. Also on October 13, 1902, Teddy Roosevelt threatens to work the coal mines with federal troops if the strike does not end. Roosevelt was a mouthpiece for powerful industrialists in this country. He was quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is a victim of conspiracy and injustice." Economic philosophy of Teddy Roosevelt. Also on October 13th in 1909, educator, rationalist, and founder of the public modern school system, Francesco Furer, is killed by Spanish Catholic monarchs. He was opposed to the influence of state religion and dogmas. He hated the Catholic Church monopolizing education in Spain, and they hated Führer. An anarchist militant and free thinker, he was blamed for the upheavals during the tragic week in July in Barcelona. After his execution, capitals throughout Europe, demonstrations are held protesting the execution of Führer. Violent confrontations between the protesters and the police occur in Paris, where over 500,000 people turned out. In Argentina, where 20,000 workers will have a general strike, which will last until October 17th. On a second anniversary 2 years later, protesters continue in the anniversary of Führer's death. A professor at Columbia University in New York is fired for daring to share a platform with Emma Goldman as more Führer modern schools are opened up around the world. 5 years later, in 1914, multiple bombs are planted at churches throughout New York, and anti-anarchist sentiments increase, which will lead to things like the Palmer Raids. Also born on this date in 1925, Lenny Bruce, stand-up comic, social rebel, hounded to death by cops throughout his career. Imprisoned on obscenity charges, as the shows are banned throughout England and Australia as well. Nightclub owners, fearing police harassment, begin refusing to book him and his career collapses. Lastly, it's been recently revealed that on this date in 1970, the CIA paid Chilean military $20,000 to assassinate the duly elected president of Chile, Allende. This week in radical history for October 14th, 1864, the first African-American daily newspaper, the New Orleans Tribune, begins publishing in both French and English. Also on October 14, 1912, Teddy Roosevelt, campaigning in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is shot at close range by anarchist William Schreck. Also on this date in 1985, Attorney General Ed Meese would be quoted as saying, "If a person is innocent of a crime, then he is not a suspect." So much for innocent until proven guilty. Also on October 14, 1994, commie folk singer Pete Seeger receives the 1994 National Medal of the Arts from President Clinton.
Fortunate to have back on our show a man who was on the first show of the season. He's a major influence on American music, and he's written such songs as "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?", "Turn, Turn, Turn," and with Lee Hayes of the Weavers, the song "If I Had a Hammer." And also such songs as "Michael Row the Boat Ashore," "On Top of Old Smoky," "Goodnight Irene," "Kisses Sweeter Than Wine," and "Weem Away" are just a few of the songs that he has introduced and kept alive through his singing. We're very proud to have this man on our show, not only because he's a great man, a fine man, and a great performer, but also because he performs rarely on television. In fact, he's only made one major television appearance in the last 17 years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to present on our show for the second time, Mr. Pete Seeger.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
What was not mentioned in the intro that you just heard is that the reason why Pete was not on the TV for 17 years was because he was blacklisted during a McCarthy hearing, witch hunts. And though the Supreme Court would rule in Seeger's favor years later, that he has the right not to discuss his political affiliations, he, like so many others, were still blacklisted for many, many years. When his mother's brothers bravely brought him back onto the airways, his song that he played on that show, The Big Muddy, was pulled from the show airways. The Smother Brothers protested, and he got him back on the show, and that was the intro you just heard. However, their show would also be taken off the air for insisting that Seeger be allowed back on the show to sing the song, The Big Muddy. Here's that controversial song by Pete Seeger.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fools had to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. All at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where he'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool set to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health.
But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. They're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
This week in Radical History for October 15th, 1892, the 1.8 million acres of the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana is opened by white settlers, forced proclamation issued by President Harrison. Also on this date in 1997, El Salvador, President Romero is deposed by the military coup. In February of 1981, the U.S. admits having sent 18 CIA advisors to help the military junta. Then, as in today, here's a brief report on U.S. intervention in the up-and-coming El Salvador elections, this segment from Latin Radical Radio.
You tell us a little bit about what the Minister for Foreign Affairs from El Salvador said last week in the United States.
Hi, Warwick. Very interestingly, after the recent discussions that the United States Solidarity Groups had in El Salvador with the ambassador from the United States to El Salvador, where the United States admitted its previous interference in internal affairs of El Salvador. This time around, the United States would not be looking at direct interference, or even indirect, if you like, interference that could be attributable to the United States in the coming Salvadoran elections. So when you then have the foreign minister of the nation, Marisol Argueta, going before the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., specifically asking for United States intervention, I guess that's put that ambassador in an interesting situation now with these comments by Minister Argueta, not just comments but appeal for United States intervention. I mean, she specifically put to the United States, to the Conservative American Enterprise Institute in Washington, that the proposition that losing in El Salvador would be not just devastating for the security and national interests of the oligarchy within El Salvador, but also for the United States. A big call that she's put out there, you know, from one fascist right-wing government to the supporting interests in neighbouring imperialist United States.
It's deja vu all over again. More illegal, more moral U.S. involvement in South America, for on this date in 1984, the Associated Press reports the existence of a CIA-prepared terrorism manual advising right-wing Nicaraguan rebels how to blackmail unwilling civilians into supporting their cause, how to arrange deaths of fellow rebels to create martyrs, and how to kidnap and kill, or as the manual puts it, neutralize government officials. This manual was first revealed by the Baltimore Sun in January, but the U.S. media, including the Washington Post and New York Times, buried it for years.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 16th, in 1859, white American abolitionist John Brown led an attack on Harper's Ferry, a U.S. arsenal in Virginia. With a group of about 20 men, five of whom were black, John Brown attacked and captured the arsenal with the intention of distributing the weapons and inspiring a slave revolt throughout the South. Although they managed to get into the arsenal, the raid was short-lived because Southern citizens and militia soon cornered Brown and his followers. When the U.S. Marines arrived, they stormed the arsenal, killing many of the rebels. The rest of them were captured and eventually hanged, including John Brown. John Brown was the first white abolitionist in America to engage in an insurrection against the institution of slavery. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on October 16, 1893, Emma Goldman is sentenced to Blackwell's Island Penitentiary for 1 year, her crime given a speech. In 1919, the Deportation Act to rid U.S. of anarchist aliens, thousands including Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman jailed and sent packing to Russia. Quoting Emma, "And you, are you so forgetful of your past? Is there no echoes in your soul of your poet's songs, your dreamer's dreams, your rebel's calls?" Emma Goldman. Lastly, for October 16th in 1998, Abraham Lincoln Brigade is honored. more than 60 years after they took up arms against the fascists of Spain, of which Hemingway romanticized them and the FBI files blacklisted them, members of the anarchist all-volunteer Lincoln Brigade had finally been given an official monument in this country, as U.S. nor England at the time would raise a finger to help fight the fascists. This week in Radical History for October 17th, I only have one item. In 1920, John Reed, American radical journalist, dies in Moscow at age 32, chronicled the Mexican and Soviet revolutions, wrote the book 10 Days That Would Shock the World. Reed is the only American buried in Red Square. For a good movie about his life and his run-ins with the character in the movie Emma Goldman, see the 1981 movie Reds, starring Warren Beatty. That is the movie Reds.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 18th in 1968, black American track medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos were suspended from the U.S. Olympic team for publicly displaying the black power fist at the Mexico City Olympic Games 2 days earlier. As the American flag rose and the Star Spangled Banner played, both Smith and Carlos had bowed their heads and raised their fists to represent black pride and unity. The gesture had been inspired by a recent movement encouraging black athletes to boycott the Olympics in protest of the oppression that black people still faced in America, despite the efforts of the civil rights movement. The display of resistance enraged many white Americans who stated that Olympic Games were supposed to be apolitical. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. On this day, October 19th, in 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell graduated from Geneva Medical College in New York, becoming the first woman in the United States to receive a medical degree. Elizabeth was originally born in England to a family that encouraged both their daughters and their sons to pursue a formal education. Upon moving to America, she joined the abolitionist cause as well as becoming an active women's rights advocate. After completing graduate studies in a London hospital, Elizabeth returned to the U.S., but finding herself barred from practicing in American hospitals, she established a medical clinic in New York for women and children. 10 years later, she founded a women's medical college there to train women physicians. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There is a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they all were put in boxes, little boxes all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martini dry, and all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university where they all got put in boxes and they all came out the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You've been listening to more of Pete Seeger, and this has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI, whose audio I borrowed. Thanks to the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website for a whole lot of radical info I use in the show, and the Slingshot organizer for the inspiration for this piece. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said: if voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son. He'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Sing it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Oh, workers, can you stand it? Be a lousy scab, or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? To you I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. Most Americans are feeling the economic squeeze of higher prices and stagnating or falling wages. Add a bank meltdown to that, and you have families living in real distress. Professor Michael Zweig of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York says the official poverty rate doesn't begin to tell the real story.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the only measure of economic distress that they have is the poverty level. That's what they count. That's what they measure. And by official government poverty standards, the poverty rate is around 12.2%, 12.3%. What we have found is that if you look at broader understanding of economic distress, it's around 21% of the households in the United States, almost double.
With the economy in meltdown and a track record of Republican-led disasters from Iraq to Katrina, Barack Obama has the momentum heading into the final weeks of the presidential campaign. One of the unknown elements on Election Day, though, will be how big a factor lingering racism may be in the voting. In a speech earlier this year, AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Rich Trumka directly addressed the race issue that could still cost Obama critical working-class votes in key states.
We can't tap dance around the fact that there's a lot of folks out there. They just can't get past the idea that there's something wrong with voting for a black man. Well, those of us who know better can't afford to sit silently or look the other way while it's happening.
Labor's effort for Obama is paying off in a southern red state. Polls show Obama leading in Virginia, a state that hasn't voted Democratic since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Dan Duncan of the Northern Virginia Central Labor Council is excited about Obama's lead in Virginia.
Fantastic. That is something that we've been drooling at, and we still think we're dreaming. We've got so many good folks here volunteering from all their union for a right to work for less state, like Virginia is. Our union members get this, they know what it means, and they're out here and they're helping. I think three simple words say it: jobs, jobs, jobs.
More than 25,000 machinists at Boeing are entering the second month of their strike. Tom Robleski, president of International Association of Machinists, District 751 in Seattle, says that strikers remain resolute as they enjoy widespread support in their fight for a good contract.
Nearly every union out here is doing whatever they can do to support us, whether it's coming and putting time in on the picket line, bringing by coffee, donuts, a bag of groceries, or financial support. They are there with us. They support us. They know that your fight is what makes the labor community strong, and they will benefit from your fight.
To get WINS labor news right on your cell phone, just dial 425-527-7001. That's 425-527-7001. Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Thank you.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.